All right, so exploring the body in Vedana, what we've done so far, needs to be rooted in direct experience and not theorizing about it. There might be a point where we actually reflect a bit. For example, this morning I was reflecting on my experience using sati to recollect some of the practice that I've been doing on the sutta, and that was very helpful. But that's different than when we're actually meditating and trying to come into direct contact. So we've got listening, reflecting, meditating, right? All very valuable. So you might want to reflect. I actually found it very helpful this morning. If you want to use some journaling, which isn't so much reinforcing the story of your life, or you might just notice if you're doing that, but just a few little notes is helpful. Great. Exploring the body in Vedana needs to be rooted in direct experience, not fabricated experience. Okay, so when we're meditating, we're not trying to create the experience we think we're supposed to be having in that instruction. If we remember Buddhadasa talking about exploring each object of meditation and each instruction as drinking that experience, so we're really tasting the flavor of what we're sensitive to when it's there. And when it's not, we've got the breath. And to the degree we can, just have sort of open awareness, the body, the breath. And even the term, when it says sensitive to in the sutta, Buddhadasa explains the term is, there's too many consonants, patis mvaden, which a Czechoslovakian word, no, it's patismvedin, which means experience, feeling, enjoying or suffering, whatever the case may be. So we're enjoying, experiencing, or suffering in the experience, whatever it may be. So it's an experiencing. And some of you might find yourself getting a little heady or even feeling alienated. So all the more important to be based in the body and use the body to help us. And this is why the body tetrad comes first in the sequence. So what are we doing when we're aware of the body? We can be aware of everything that's happening in our experience in a grounded way through the bodily sensations that are happening right now. So we can even just experience thought in the body, yeah? So you're thinking, but in a way you're just experiencing the body. And anything can manifest through the body. Don't get into too much of a head trip about that. In a way, I'm just saying, whatever's going on, you can just experience the body, yeah, and let that be the doorway by which you're experiencing yourself. Being the body is a way of knowing what's happening, a very grounded way of knowing what's happening. I had a personal breakthrough this morning thinking about this, because I've felt for a long time the body is really important to meditation, and I've just been trying to reflect on why that is, you know, for years actually. And this morning, something became clear to me. You know, in Buddhism, the first dhyana is emphasized as the place where we would not go any further if we wanted to do Dharma Vachaya work or Vipassana Bhavana work. What does that mean? So when I was saying to you, we can't get attached to going to some place and blissing out, right? So there are further states, which we actually can learn from, but in those states, the sense of the thinking drops away, active thinking drops away, and the sense of the body drops away. Those are jhanas which you could explore. Ayakama, who is myself, that book is very good for that if that's terrain that's familiar to you. But actually, Buddhism emphasizes stability of mind through these five factors. I mean, this sutta, we've seen it, right? Through being able to turn our attention towards something, to experience it, to basically be concentrated, and to have a quality of enjoyed engagement with it. Enjoyed, I just made up a word. Pleasurable engagement with it. Through piti and sukha, right? So we've got vitakka, vichara, ekaggata, piti and sukha, the five dhyana factors. And it emphasizes having these to support a stability of mind so then we can then do Dharma Vachaya or Vipassana Bhavana work. So what occurred to me this morning is in those states, and it's usually said we need those states because thinking is available, but I was actually thinking this morning that in those states the body's available. The sense of the body has not yet dropped away. So the body as an instrument of knowing is available to us, and I think that's equally or extremely important. I was thinking, in a way, you could somatically meditate all the way to enlightenment. Depends on your temperament. I think I'm a very somatic meditator. It's interesting because I have a very active mind, but when I meditate, it's pretty much in the body. I'm not labeling experience, although I know some people find it useful. But me personally, it's more a sensing through the body experience, yeah, contracting, letting go, letting be. It's very physically based. Even if I'm aware of thoughts, I just personally tend to do it very much through the body. Yeah, we emphasize thought being available in the first dhyana, or when these five factors are present. Yeah, but actually, I'm quite interested in the body being available then. I do think that first tetrad, or the mindfulness of breathing in the four stages, can be a complete practice, working just through the body. And if we bring a recollection of the nature of that experience, which we just started to do, right? Notice things change, notice that things are impermanent. And as we see this change, sense of self can loosen just through the experience of the breath. It can be a complete practice, that first tetrad, or the four stages of the mindfulness of breathing. And in a way, we don't even really need to introduce that contemplation. I think if we're just awake in the four-stage mindfulness of breathing, it's what we're noticing. So we don't need to fabricate that either. But we can also experience things directly in the mind. So we don't have to go through the body. It's just that I think the body's quite a good corrector, balance, antidote to being feeling like you're alienated. It's just all getting a bit heady, and what is all this anyway? And do I have toes? It's very kind of down to earth. So we can also experience things directly in the mind. And we're going to start making that available as well. So four factors contribute to alienation. So I think we all need to look out for this. If it's not feeling like a problem, you don't need to make it one, but just so that you were aware in the course of your practice about this. This is not a traditional teaching. It's just from this morning reflecting on it. So the first contribution to an alienated state is losing the samatha basis. So we lose track of what's happening now. Either through forgetfulness, we become absent-minded and we're just not connected to what's happening in the moment, or because we just need to give more attention to this aspect of practice as a whole. Okay, so we need to spend more time working in the samatha way. So this is kind of like alienation through a clouded mind. And what to do? If that's the case, you're feeling that, focus on samatha and simple methods that bring you back to what's happening now very directly. Develop your proficiency with those methods and working with your mind in those ways. Come on to the breath very directly, for example, very simple, right? Four-stage mindfulness of breathing, but not only that, even in that we can feel alienated, finding the breath more directly. And something like that location, duration, quality can help you with that. Another factor that contributes to alienation is not being willing to experience what's happening. These are different. They may be happening at the same time. It may just be one or another thing that's happening. So this is a kind of alienation through aversion. And I think we all have this going on to some degree. It's a matter of degree in a way. Sometimes it's not there, but in the course of our life, it can pop up. And when we catch it, if we can catch it before it hardens, that can keep it from hardening into something more solidified that we might call feeling alienated. But if it's really hardening and solidifying, then we might feel like there's an overall sense of feeling alienated and quite unconnected with ourselves. What to do? I think more metta practice, if this is what's going on, is helpful. If you're not sure, this would be a good place to have a meditation review. Is it, I just need to be more concentrated, more present, or is it aversion? Okay, so one of the benefits of metta practice is it helps us to be willing to experience the whole of our experience with a friendly attitude, so we're not trying to stave off or chop off parts of it, you know, which creates tension and a feeling of alienation. So whether it's painful, pleasant, neutral, whether we like it or dislike it, whether we want or don't want it, these metta practices help us be willing to experience the whole of whatever may present itself. And I think if we're practicing skillfully, there won't be that much difference between mindfulness of breathing and metta practice after a while, in the sense of there being just no kindness in the mindfulness of breathing practice. So if we want any kind of kindness, we have to go do the metta practice. After a while, when we're mindful of ourselves, just and it happens to be the breathing and the body we're coming onto, we'll learn to just have kindness be in the quality of attention. We'll learn what sati really is. Okay, the third factor contributing to alienation, I think, is confidence and whether we're feeling confident or not. This has to do with trusting your experience. So when you notice what's happening, whether you believe it's happening or not, in a way. So there's been a lot of questions coming which seem to hover around this area. It's kind of like, well, this is what's happening, but the Sutta says this. Sometimes it's just an honest question, a curiousness. Sometimes I wonder if people just don't trust that what's happening in them is actually what's happening in them. Yeah, and it's like something else is saying this is what should be happening, and then you start to lose all confidence about, well, what's really happening, and should this be happening, and why isn't this other thing happening? And you start to get really disconnected and lost in all that, you know. So being based in your own experience. So this is alienation through doubt, I was thinking. Yeah, we can apply the Dharma to our experience, but not lose being based in our experience and what's actually happening. So you may apply the Dharma to your experience and you experience that you're confused. Okay? Well then, that's what you're experiencing. So knowing what's happening in you to be what's happening with, and not needing external confirmation for that. Just working on that. And the fourth factor that contributes to alienation, I was thinking, is pacing. I've been talking about working at your own pace. If you start to push too hard, I think you can get alienated. So this is alienation from unwise effort. If you start to get fatigued, get more anxious, yeah, you're just creating an overall tension within yourself. It also relates to just letting things be. So if you're pushing really hard and exhausting yourself, trying to make everything happen on this retreat, you know, like, I've got this retreat to get enlightened and got to make it all happen. This is also kind of pacing, right? Like, just trying to push everything to happen. So what to do? Back off. Don't be so hard on yourself. Even though this life is slipping away, just pushing ourselves harder isn't going to help. So I was thinking, this is about knowing when to play and laugh and when to lie down and rest and when to just go to bed, you know. And we can do these things in silence. So we can play, we can be playful in ourselves in silence. Just because it's a silent meditation retreat doesn't mean we have to go around, you know, somber. And I mean, we might be in a somber mood, that's fine. If that's what's authentically happening, great. Try smiling once in a while, it wouldn't kill you. Thich Nhat Hanh, even in the meditation posture, suggests a very subtle smile. Not anything that feels too forced, but very subtle, gentle smile. Ooh. Okay, so that's what I love about Ryokan, actually. If you read his poetry, he's a very committed practitioner. He's living in this hut with a big hole in the roof in the winter while it's raining. I mean, he's no wimp. But he has poems like this. Every day, day after day, I spend at my ease playing with the children. In the sleeves of my robe, two or three balls. A useless fellow, yes, but I know how to make myself drunk, sipping my fill of the peaceful springtime. So there's a sense there of freedom in his poetry, I think. Yeah. Okay, and then there's one more thing we might be getting heady about. So maybe what we're getting heady about is that thing about moving from feeling to dukkha to shraddha. I thought I'd read something from Sangharakshita to clarify what this means. That help you? What this means is that when sensations and experiences impinge upon us, we do not have to react with craving. Okay, so there was one path that went feeling, craving, grasping. We can react instead in a positive way. As we experience pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings, we can begin to see, to feel, that none of them are really very satisfactory, not even the pleasant ones. Even they are not enough. Even if we could perpetuate pleasant experiences and eliminate painful ones, there would still be some hidden lack, something unsatisfied and frustrated. So we begin to see, we begin to feel, we begin to realize that this whole conditioned existence, our life, our ordinary experience is not enough. It cannot give us permanent, true satisfaction or happiness. If we analyze it deeply, in the long run, it is unsatisfactory. As we start to see that this is so, we begin to sit loose to mundane existence. And then he talks about going for refuge, really, beginning to place our heart on something that might transcend just these ups and downs, these constant ups and downs. So the experience of dukkha kind of arises with Vedana. And so it's not just the dukkha of reacting to it. It's actually the dukkha of seeing it just all comes and goes. Would we be happy if we could have chocolate cake just 24 hours a day? Would that do it? We're constantly chasing these things and trying to orchestrate our life so we have them. But even if we had them all, would that be enough? So I think there's something there about wanting to have meaning in our life. So it's not that pleasure isn't pleasurable sort of on its own level, but there might be more to us than just wanting to constantly have sensual pleasures. And I think if we look at the life story of the Buddha, we can see this, because he had all these sensual pleasures, right? And in the end, it was a question about, well, what's the nature of human suffering then, you know? I can orchestrate all these pleasures in my life. In fact, they're orchestrated for me. People do my bidding. And then yet, in the world, human beings are suffering from old age, sickness, and death. We could look around and see the oppression of war, the oppression of intolerance, all these things. So is it enough for us to go create our own happy little world while this is all going on? So there's also something of our interconnectedness in it, yeah? Which is, I think, just in our nature. So can we just go create this happy, padded little world and just try not to witness the whole of human life? That creates a strain, too. So even that attempt creates strain. That's what Rosenberg, I think, was saying when he had that little line. It's a very little line, but I think it's quite significant that even piti and sukha have a certain existential loneliness to them, a trace of me and mine. It's not to say that they're not beneficial in helping calm the mind. I mean, what is it to just go blissed out like that? What does that mean when you step out into the world, that you've just gone and blissed out like that? You know, I'm not saying one thing or the other, but it's a question.